Good morning all, and can I begin by paying my respects to the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation on whose lands we're meeting, and acknowledge their elders past and present, and particularly acknowledge their youth as I do with all youth of Australia, because they're our future leaders. They're the ones that we must invest in, and they're the ones who we must guide and lead into the future, because they are our future. Thank you, Michael, again for your welcome to country and kind words. And it's always good to really meet, and we chose this venue specifically in Redfern, because this is really the heartland of many of the struggles of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs in Australia. Can I also acknowledge Bradley, representing the Attorney General, Rita, representing Jenny Macklin, and also acknowledge the Attorney General's staff for ensuring that the reports, both reports, were tabled on Wednesday, and being able to see through that process, because yeah, there is a process, and it's always an arduous one, but they put in the effort with my staff to make sure that it all happened, so that during my term as Social Justice Commissioner, we were able to launch the 2009 reports. Could I also acknowledge Barry Collier on behalf of the Premier, Christina Keneally, and also my old friend Graham Neat, who's the President of the National Native Title Tribunal. Thank you, Cathy, for your very kind words. And, you know, it was just thinking about it, and I was feeling tired, you know, just reliving some of those. And you know, believe me, that's not all. There are many things that we've done at the local level, you know, that's made a difference, and been able to contribute to change, and that's important. And as you know, there was a mention of 35 years. Well, I'm actually into my 39th year now. I've just started in the public service, so that'll be the end of it for me when I retire at the end of next week. I'd also like to acknowledge the work of all the organisations and government people who are involved in Indigenous affairs, because it's your work that's able, and if we can work together on it and focus on a common goal towards the end, we'll be able to see change. Thank you to all the interstaters and our overseas visitor, Joris, my colleague from the New Zealand Human Rights Commission, you know, for coming over to share with us. But also a big welcome to all my Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander brothers and sisters and aunties and uncles and all the friends who are here, you know, who are supporting human rights, supporting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs, because, you know, unless we work together, we're not going to see the changes that we need to see. As Cathy mentioned, we're here today to launch the annual Social Justice and Native Title Reports. And as many of you are aware, these reports fulfil the statutory responsibility of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. And whilst this is very important, I'd like to start today by reflecting on some of the broader significance of these reports. The Social Justice and Native Title Reports assess and promote the implementation of government policies and practices during any reporting year, and the reporting year goes from the 1st of July to the 30th of June each year. And it's all about, as Cathy had mentioned, the impacts of government policies and programs on the enjoyment of human rights by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. But these reports are also fundamental in providing the government and other stakeholders with the guidance about policies, laws and processes that are developed for us, and I mean us as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, an impact on our access to human rights, our everyday lives and our futures. And that's why they're significant. But they're also significant because they're not just my thoughts about these issues. They include the voices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and the inputs from our peak bodies and representative organisations about the issues that are important to all of us. They promote the good and the hard work being done on the ground in our communities, and they provide examples of the initiatives for our communities to develop that have been developed locally. They let governments know where investment is needed to make a real change in our lives and the lives of our communities. And these reports provide our people with an opportunity to participate in the governance of our lives in our communities. And they have become a critical resource in Indigenous policy development and are a solid example of how we, as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, can access, promote and defend our collective human rights as recognised under the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It's with great pride, gratitude and a touch of sadness that I present these, the sixth and final set of reports, as the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. As many of you are aware, and have been talked, that I do finish my term at the end of January. And can I say that the past 5.5 years has been a great privilege for me to work around the country with our people and for our people on a wide range of issues. And some of these were hard issues to deal with, while others ignited my pride and my passion as an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander man in knowing that we have got a future. And though while there's too many to list here today, some of the highlights of my term as Social Justice Commissioner, and they've been said, but I'll reiterate them, which are also addressed in the reports table today in particular, but some of them over the last 5 years include the development of the Close the Gap Indigenous Health Equality Campaign, the establishment of the National Congress for Australia's First People, the government's considered support and their reconsideration of the support for the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and I should acknowledge the most recent acknowledgement by the opposition leader and the opposition shadow attorney general in declaring their support for the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, considering that the previous government were one of the four countries of the world who opposed it, but now there's been a change of heart. Well, there appears to be, and that's welcomed. And while I'm the eternal optimist, and sometimes never ever thought it would happen in my lifetime, I think the national apology to the stolen generations, was something that lifted us as a nation, and it's also been the catalyst to start in the development of a National Healing Foundation. As a nation, we were relieved and inspired by the Prime Minister's apology to the stolen generations. As Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, we cried the tears, with tears of sadness and tears of joy, and we exhaled. And at this site here at Redfern in Sydney, many Australians gathered together to witness one of the greatest acts of compassion in our country's history. In the words of the Prime Minister in his apology to the stolen generations and their descendants, he said, "The time has come for our nation to turn a new page in Australia's history by righting the wrongs of the past and moving forward with confidence to the future." The apology was a first step towards creating Australia, an Australia that is inclusive and embracing of its First Peoples. The 2009 Social Justice and Native Title reports build on the momentum of the apology. They consider critical issues for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, and they include crucial steps necessary for overcoming Indigenous disadvantage and setting equal life chances for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the only acceptable benchmark that we should have. The Social Justice Report 2009 provides a comprehensive chronology, and I'd really encourage you to read that chronology, of the events throughout the year that impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Because I think, this year we devoted another 30 pages to writing down and recording all the different policies by state and territory governments and local governments and the federal government that impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And when you look at the quantum of events that take place, it's overwhelming to think that any sector of our society can cope with so much change and still have the resilience to be able to move forward. The report also considered three substantial issues. This is a social justice report. The first is justice reinvestment to reduce the overrepresentation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in the criminal justice system. The second is the protection and promotion of Indigenous languages. And the third is sustaining our Aboriginal homelands communities. On the face of it, the issues in this report may look disconnected, but at their essence, they all speak of the need for policies that embrace our unique cultures and identities and aim to create strong, vibrant and healthy Indigenous communities. Justice reinvestment provides a new approach that may hold the key to unlocking Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people from the cycle of crime and escalating imprisonment rates. The urgency of addressing this issue is evident in the alarming statistics that are unnecessary and unacceptable. Nationally, adult Indigenous people are 13 times more likely to be imprisoned than non-Indigenous people, and Indigenous juveniles are 28 times more likely to be placed in juvenile detention than their non-Indigenous counterparts. In the last 5 years alone, we as a nation witnessed two devastating examples of the ramifications of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander incarceration and over-policing, with the deaths of Murrunji Dumuji on Palm Island in Queensland. And that's still subject of a coronial inquiry. And on the other side of the country, the death of Mr Ward, who died of heat stroke as a result of being transported from Laverton to Kalgoorlie, approximately 360 kilometres in the back of a prison van, in which the temperature rose to in excess of 47 degrees. Over the year, and particularly in response to the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths and Custody in 1991, some worthy initiatives have been developed to address the over-representation of in the criminal justice system by our people. But unfortunately, these statistics show that what we're doing is simply not working, and alternative solutions are required. Now, justice reinvestment is a localised criminal justice policy approach that diverts a proportion of the funds spent on imprisonment to local communities where there's a high concentration of offenders. The monies that would have been spent on imprisonment are reinvested in programs and services in the community where these issues are most acute, in order to address the underlying causes of crime. Here in Australia, increasing amounts of public monies are spent on imprisonment for minimum positive long-term returns. But internationally, where justice reinvestment is being implemented, and particularly in the UK and the US, imprisonment rates are dropping. For example, in Oregon in the United States, money was reinvested into well-resourced restorative justice and community service programs for juvenile offenders, and this has resulted in a 72% drop in juvenile incarceration rates. So justice reinvestment is based on evidence that a large proportion of offenders come from a relatively small number of disadvantaged communities. And demographic mapping and cost analysis in the United States has identified what they call million-dollar blocks, where literally millions of dollars are being spent on imprisoning people from certain neighbourhoods. And for instance, in one of those neighbourhoods, known as the Hill in Connecticut, $20 million was spent in 1 year to imprison 387 people. So the Hill is disproportionately made up of low-income African-Americans. Now, this concentration of offenders logically suggests that there should be a commensurate concentration of services and programs to prevent offending in these communities. And this is an important departure from the current individually focused correctional policy. Current correctional policies promote individual and group programs but provide little support for community regeneration and community capacity building. So the bottom line is that if you put money on individual offenders if you get an offender and you put them through the best resourced, most effective rehabilitation programs, but if they're returning to the community with few opportunities, their chances of staying out of prison are very limited. Their chances of reoffending are very high. The justice reinvestment model still retains prisons as a measure for dangerous and serious offenders, but it actively shifts the focus away from imprisonment to the provision of community-wide services that build capacity within the community to prevent people from offending and ending up in the criminal justice system in the first place. And I'll note that the government has recently announced $500,000 of funding to the North Australian Justice Agency to work with Aboriginal prisoners to stop them reoffending, and has committed to distributing the $6 million that is confiscated under the Proceeds of Crime Act to community groups to prevent crime and also on Indigenous prisoner projects. Now, this is a good start, but it is just a start, and it will require a long-term and concerted effort before we'll see any enduring outcomes. And justice reinvestment is as much about economics as it is about good social policy, And it is a tried and tested model, and that's the importance. It's a tried and tested model in both the United States and the United Kingdom that will produce positive results. The second issue I address is also critical to building the strength and resilience of our communities and ensuring the maintenance of our culture and identity. That is the preservation and promotion of Indigenous languages. Now, this issue also requires an urgent response because, unfortunately, in Australia, due to past and present government policies, Indigenous languages are critically endangered. The endangerment of Indigenous languages was reported as an issue of international concern in the recently released State of the World's Indigenous Peoples Report, put out by the United Nations, and it's actually put out by the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. It is estimated that 4,000 of the 7,000 languages spoken today are spoken by Indigenous peoples. However, language specialists predict that up to 90% of the world's languages are likely to become extinct or threatened with extinction by the end of the century. In Australia, prior to colonisation, 250 distinct languages, which included over 600 dialects, were spoken across the country, and 100 of these languages only still exist in Australia. However, most of them are at various stages of becoming extinct. Today, only 18 Indigenous languages in Australia are currently spoken by all generations of peoples within a given language group. So without intervention, it's estimated that Indigenous languages in Australia and the usage of those languages will cease within the next 10 to 30 years. So for a country that's home to the world's longest surviving continuous culture, that prides itself on its cultural heritage value and its multiculturalism, this is a serious indictment on our nation. The loss of Indigenous languages in Australia is a loss for all Australians. Cultural knowledge that is crucial to our enjoyment of this country as a nation is carried through our Indigenous languages. Where languages are eroded or lost, so too is the cultural knowledge. This in turn has the potential to impact on the health and well-being of Indigenous peoples. Addressing national priorities such as climate change, which also rely on Indigenous cultural knowledge that is contained within that's contained within these languages. And as a result, this will also affect the health and well-being of all Australians. And with climate change looming, it's a priority we must address. And there's strong evidence to support the preservation and promotion of Indigenous languages, and they include improved cognitive functioning in children who are bilingual, enjoyment of better social, economic and health outcomes by minority groups who speak their language and practice their culture, better than those who don't, and cultural knowledge that has been proven to assist in the employment of Indigenous peoples in Australia. And finally, the economic and social costs associated with the loss of languages, which is I've described earlier. So as I've mentioned earlier, up until the 1970s, assimilationist and prohibitionist policies banned or discouraged Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people from speaking our languages, and this has resulted in their rapid decline. As recently as 2008, our languages continued to be threatened by government policies, with the Northern Territory government introducing a policy that dismantles bilingual education. And this policy makes it mandatory to teach students in English in the first 4 hours of the school day. So by relegating Indigenous language instruction to the last hour and a half of the school afternoon, this policy effectively abolishes one of the most effective methods of keeping Indigenous languages alive in this country. It significantly reduces the ability for successive generations of our people to develop full competency in their own language. And it also takes away the serious competitive advantage that we may have in employment, because many employment options for Indigenous peoples, particularly in remote areas, but I'd argue across Australia, are based on our knowledge of our language and our culture. So if you think about it, we have potential employment opportunities to work as liaison officers between our communities and the mainstream government departments, although I do acknowledge that we do need to be fluent in both Indigenous languages as well as English to be able to undertake these jobs. And knowledge of our languages and culture also assists us to work in jobs such as rangers, land care specialists, tourism operators and cultural guides, and as artists who pass down cultural knowledge through weaving, painting and sculpture. So if you take away our language and culture, you're also taking away many of the opportunities that exist. Governments need to think clearly about what it is that they're trying to achieve with these policies. The policy to abolish bilingual education is, in fact, cultural vandalism. And it's an act which limits the life chances rather than enhancing the life chances of Aboriginal people in those nine bilingual schools in the Territory. The Australian government has made every effort to support our languages by introducing, to support our languages by introducing Australia's first national language policy exclusively focused on protecting and promoting Indigenous languages. And it's known as the Indigenous Languages, a National Approach 2009. Now, whilst the policy provides a starting point to preserve and revitalising our invaluable languages, it will not be enough on its own, and state and territory governments need to come on board. They have a responsibility for school education, and they need to make sure that their policies support our languages. And if you don't take action soon, Indigenous languages will be extinct within the next few generations. And if we take a leaf out of the book, and I cover this quite extensively in the report, what I don't cover is the situation in Wales and the United Kingdom, where they, for the last 50 years, have been trying to preserve and revitalise the Welsh language, and it's only starting to see successes now after that time. But it does require a very significant understanding on the first hand by politicians, and secondly, having the bureaucrats and the politicians work to get out policies that are going to support and foster and develop Aboriginal language preservation. So I urge you, if you're able, to do whatever you can to bring this injustice out into the open. The parents of the school children who are losing bilingual education are very distressed, and many of them have contacted my office and my officers, and they're doing everything they can to preserve the bilingual program, but their pleas seem to be falling on deaf ears. So this leads me to the third issue addressed in this year's Social Justice Report, sustaining Aboriginal homeland communities. Homelands are located in Aboriginal ancestral lands, on Aboriginal ancestral lands with cultural and spiritual significance to the Aboriginal people who live there. They are homeland communities, and there are homeland communities throughout Australia, but the majority are being in the Northern Territory, West Australia and South Australia. And homelands vary in size, composition, level of resources and the extent of their access to basic essential services such as potable water. And some may be very small, comprising of only a few families living together, while others may be expanding and developing their own economies and have populations of over 100 people. And while some homelands have grown into significant sized communities, in most cases they are smaller than townships and regional centres. So evidence shows that homelands provide social, spiritual, cultural, health and economic benefits to their residents. They are a unique component of the Indigenous social and cultural landscape, enabling residents to live on their traditional lands, which are governed through traditional kinship structures and provide leadership and local governance. So living on homelands are also makes the fulfilment of cultural, spiritual and environmental obligations much easier than if residents were not living on their own traditional lands. So despite these positive outcomes and feedback from Aboriginal people living in homelands to maintain and support them, Australian governments have pursued policies that remove or restrict resources and support provided to homeland communities. So this effectively moves homeland residents into larger rural townships to access housing, education, health and other services. In 2005, you might recall that Amanda Vanstone, the then Federal Minister for Indigenous Affairs, described homeland communities as cultural museums that are too small to warrant government support. The irony is that while most museums are considered to be culturally valuable and are supported by government, our homelands are not given the same priority. So failure by governments to support the ongoing development of homeland communities could further endanger the world's longest surviving continuous culture. History has also shown that moving people from homeland communities into fringe communities in rural towns increases the stresses on resources in rural townships, resulting in increased social tension between different community groups, reduced access to healthy food and lifestyles, and loss of cultural traditions, practices and livelihoods. So in response to recent significant changes to government policies in the Northern Territory to limit the resources and support for homeland communities, I've focused the discussion in the report specifically on homeland communities located in the Northern Territory to demonstrate and promote successful Aboriginal community development, governance and self-determination. And I've also included a number of case studies from the Lanapoi Homelands Association Incorporated, the Mount Theo Outstation and Maparu, that highlight the diversity of success in these homelands. And for example, some homeland communities are participating in land management and conservation projects on their traditional country. And this is include projects like fire abatement projects that serve to mitigate the effects of climate change. The Central Land Councils have compiled evidence of activity on land management, resource development, seed collection, the management of feral animals and introduced plant species in some of the remotest areas of Australia. And all of these activities are employment opportunities for individuals and actions to protect the biodiversity of Australia's flora and fauna. Resource management projects on homelands generate opportunities for conservation and economic development. And one example of this activity is the Working on Country program. That's a federal government program that funds Aboriginal people to maintain, restore and protect their lands and seas, building on the value of traditional knowledge in land management. Participating in the art and craft industry has also been another source of economic development for many homeland communities, as well as being a means of practicing and revitalising Indigenous cultural traditions and customs. And these ventures have been possible because the artists have been living on country, maintaining their cultural traditions and creating art arising from cultural knowledge. So programs such as these are able to combine benefits of community and culture with commercial benefits. Homelands create a space for the development of innovative strategies for economic development that comply with cultural practices and the right to self-determination. So as I've stressed throughout my term, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are connected to and responsible for our traditional lands and waters, and in turn we obtain and maintain our spirit and our cultural identity, life and livelihood from our lands and from our waters. So recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's ownership of our lands and waters is also critical to economic development opportunities that have become vital to our cultural, physical and emotional well-being and survival post-colonisation. And this recognition is formalised through the native title system and state and territory land regimes. So the significance of homelands and our access to and ownership of our traditional lands brings me to the Native Title Report 2009. The Native Title Report 2009 consists of two main areas. Firstly, reforming the native title system, and secondly, the government's policy to secure land tenure over Indigenous lands in order to provide housing and other essential services to Indigenous communities. So as reported previously, this year's report again examines the operation of the native title system and land rights regimes and their effect on the exercise and enjoyment of human rights by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people during the 2008-2009 reporting period. So through the native title system specifically, some successes have been achieved. Agreements have been made. Mining companies are at the negotiation table with traditional owners, and that's important. State and territory governments have made some concessions, and native title has been determined across approximately 12.5% of the country. However, there's been a lack of action in other areas. Prescribed bodies corporates are still underfunded, and the Australian government has yet to advance its promised Indigenous economic development strategy. Examination of the current state of land rights and native title policy in Australia clearly demonstrates that there's still a lot of work to do if we are to achieve true and proper land justice. During my term as Social Justice Commissioner, I've consistently called on the government to reform the native title system to ensure that it is just and it is equitable. In 2007, Philip Ruddock, the previous Federal Attorney General, responded to this call by introducing initial reforms to the native title system. Now, while much of these changes have been described as only tinkering at the edges, and I've been one of those describing it as tinkering at the edges, they did start the ball rolling. Fortunately, the current Labor government has continued to pursue reforms in the native title system to improve its operation and effectiveness. And this year, Attorney General Robert McClellan introduced a range of amendments to the Native Title Act, some positive and some more controversial. He's also worked with state and territory governments through the COAG process to commit to a more flexible approach to native title and encourage broader negotiated settlement arrangements. So these changes could provide the first step towards turning the native title system into a system that it was intended to be. Some changes are being made to the existing framework, such as handing the management of the resolution of native title claims to the court process, while others, recognising the failures and restrictions of the system, are seeking to create alternatives to the existing framework. And the Victorian Alternative Land Settlement Framework is a positive example of this. However, while the Australian Government has said it is interested in exploring further reforms to the native title system and clearly identified reforms to the native title system as a strategic priority, it is disappointing that the government has reconsidered its prioritisation of the development of the Native Title Act's social justice package. As I've highlighted in a number of my reports, the Native Title reports, the Native Title Act was intended to be just one of three mechanisms to recognise and provide some reparations for the dispossession of Indigenous peoples from our lands and our waters. The Act was to be complemented by a social justice package to address broader issues in the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians, and an Indigenous land fund which would ensure that those people who could not access native title would be able to attain some form of justice for loss of their lands. Two important aspects. Now, while the Indigenous Land Fund was established, the social justice package has never been developed, and it was here at Redfern in 1992, you might remember, that former Labor Party Prime Minister Paul Keating, in his famous Redfern speech, said that there is nothing to fear or to lose from the extension of a social justice package. In preparation for the 2007 federal election, the Australian Labor Party promised to honour its commitment to implement a package of social justice measures to respond to Mabo No. 2. However, the Labor Party has since removed the reference to the social justice package in its 2009 national platform. In my view, a social justice package is integral to the effective operation of the native title system. And if the government are to truly are truly committed to improving the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, this is a priority that must be actioned rather than ignored. In addition, the social justice package, in order for the native title system to deliver worthwhile outcomes to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, we also have to address the legacy of John Howard's 10-point plan, which you might recall. For example, a number of areas within the native title system must be effectively reformed to ensure that the system provides for the needs of all parties with a legitimate interest. And I've discussed a number of these in this year's report, and they include considering ways to formally recognise traditional ownership, amending the Native Title Act to shift the burden of proof in the native title claim so that those who are most vulnerable are not lumped with the burden of challenging a system that is not designed to provide for the rights and interests of traditional owners, encouraging state and territories to adopt a more flexible approach to assessing and accepting connection evidence, improving access to land tenure information, which is currently held by state and territory governments, streamlining the role of non-government respondents to native title claims, promoting broader and more flexible native title settlement packages, and increasing the quality and the quantity of anthropologists and other experts working within the native title system. So they're all addressed in the report. As those of you here today who work in the native title system would be well aware, none of these ideas are new, and some are already being considered. However, as a nation, we are no longer in a position to tinker at the edges of the native title system. The problems with the native title system can only be addressed through a comprehensive reform process that is informed by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. In addition to the areas for reform I've raised, native title reform must be guided by human rights principles and standards. Standards such as self-determination, free, prior and informed consent, non-discrimination, the right to maintain and enjoy our distinct culture, and to determine and develop priorities and strategies for the development or use of our lands or territories and other resources. Changing the culture of the native title system will not be easy. The potential for reform will depend on the attitudes and commitments of all involved. Reform to the native title system requires political will, and I should acknowledge the work of Brian White and his national team who have been working with government to be able to try and reform the native title system. But it will also require equipment on the part of government and the corporate sector to enter into genuine partnerships with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities based on respect for our rights and the principles of free, prior and informed consent. I believe that this has been difficult in the past due to the fact that the importance of culture and its relevance to Indigenous people's relationship to land is not completely understood and acknowledged by all Australians. This is evidenced by the fact that the governments continue to develop Indigenous land policy in isolation to other social and economic areas of policy. And as a result, when governments try to be innovative, in many instances, it's in our rights and our rights to lands and waters that have to be compromised. And for example, the second issue addressed in the Native Title Report 2009 is the Australian government's approach to land tenure reform across the country. Now, while the five-year leases imposed under the Northern Territory emergency legislation and the government's new policy to secure land tenure for housing through longer-term leases aims to facilitate service delivery in Indigenous communities, including in homelands, they effectively terminate our connection and our use, access and ownership of these lands and our ability to make decisions about our future. And this is despite the application of the non-extinguishment principle. So I'm concerned about these policies and the way they impact on Aboriginal peoples across Australia in particular. And I should say that in particular I'm concerned that these policies and their impacts are not being presented to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in a clear and transparent way. We as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have fought hard for our rights to our lands to be recognised. We as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have legitimate concerns about losing controls over decision making in our communities, and these concerns are grounded in a historical legacy of control and contempt. Now, I call on governments to consider different approaches to land reform and land ownership, and I set out principles that should underpin the introduction of any land tenure reforms or home ownership schemes. And these include providing the community with clear and appropriate information, respect for the principle of free, prior and informed consent, and that respect must be at the centre of all of these principles. So when I started today, I highlighted some of the big ticket positive developments that the government has introduced since its election in 2007. I talked about the Australian government's apology to the stolen generations and support for the establishment of the National Healing Foundation, the adoption of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, formalising the COAG commitment to the Close the Gap Health Equality Campaign, and its full support for the establishment of the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples, provides the government, and I must state it does provide the government, with a solid framework for the advancement of Australia's First Peoples. And we need to get behind that and make sure that the government is kept accountable and kept moving in the right direction. The recommendations within the Social Justice and Native Title reports for 2009 relate specifically to promoting and strengthening Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's cultural identity. Cultural identity is central to each and every one of the rights contained in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and are central to our success as peoples seeking to overcome the disadvantage and the challenges that we face on a daily basis. The issues that I've addressed in these two reports start to build the framework that has been secured over the past 5 years. The core of these issues speaks to the need for a strong for strong communities and to build those communities into the strong foundation that's necessary. And so this might be through investing money in crime prevention and keeping our people out of the prisons, protecting our languages and our culture, that is the glue that keeps our communities together, supporting our homelands as a model of community development and self-determination, or securing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's rights to lands, seas, waters and territories by creating a just and equitable native title system. Our communities, be they in remote or in urban locations, are not just where we come from, but who we are. They represent our family's connections, proud history, our rich culture. And I hope that they remain strong and can in turn sustain future generations. The Social Justice and Native Title Reports for 2009 provide some ideas and recommendations to government on how to do this. And I should say that these reports aren't just for government. Whilst they're tabled in government, they're equally important for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to read and understand, and the general community to read and understand in a way so that we can support each other in our endeavours. So as I come to the end of my term, I urge governments to listen to us and work with us. Respect our voice, our rights, our land, our resources, our seas and our waters. And with this being my final launch of the Social Justice and Native Title Reports, let me again acknowledge my dedicated and talented staff, past and present, who provided me with inspiration and provided me with energy. These reports are testimony to your research, inquiry, investigation, diplomacy and writing skills. You have fairly and respectfully represented the views of many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and other collaborators you've consulted. Thank you. Can I also thank Cathy Branson and Commissioner colleagues Graham Innes and Liz Broderick for their support and encouragement during the hard times. And there's been many hard times. And so finally, can I remind all Australians that human rights are for everybody or everyone, everywhere, every day. And can I share my own personal mantra that I've talked about for a long time, and that's from self-respect comes dignity, and from dignity comes hope. Thank you.